Good evening, everyone. I'm very pleased to be asked to speak to you. I'm very pleased to be here. Just on a personal point, it's 45 years since I gave my last talk, my first address to the society. So I'm pleased to see some people around who are still here. I'm pleased to see the society still here, and I'm pleased to see that I'm still here 45 years on. Now, my talk, as the chairman has said, is about total war in Ireland. And what I want to do is to really identify my conclusions at the very beginning, because I'll be talking, unusually for me, with a lot of facts and figures, and it tend to lose sight of the wood for the trees and the trees for the woods. So the three points I want to try and make from this talk are these. First of all, I want to call attention to the enormous effort made by Ireland during the Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars. An enormous effort in terms of recruits, provisions, finance and materiel to the British war effort against Revolutionary and Napoleonic France. That's the first, just to call attention to it. The second one is that I'm trying to argue that there is a sort of a sea change in British attitudes towards Ireland from, say, 1790 to 1815. That is, the British attitude in terms of Irish politics, Irish needs, the reliability of the Irish undergoes a change in these two decades. What I would argue is that by 1815, Ireland is seen as an enemy country, with the Irish as innately disloyal, and that this is a fairly radical shift from the early 1790s. And if I can just throw one fact out, one figure in fact, that is, in 1790 there were some 10,000 British troops in Ireland. By 1815 there were 33,000, and as Lord Sidmouth said, it was not even considered enough to hold Ireland, much less govern it. So from 10,000 in 1790 to 33,000 in 1815, it seems to me that this is pointing up towards some mega shift. The last point I want to sort of identify is that the war effort made by Ireland during this period and the impact of the wars on Irish social and economic history during this period was in its turn to set up what I would see as a malignant configuration of Irish society, which was to fall apart catastrophically in the 1840s. That is, under the impact of the mass demand for food, men, materiel, the boom of the 1800 to 1850 period, followed by the bust, that this produced an effect on Irish rural society, which I would argue accelerated trends which had been there before, but which were to set up, as I say, the malignant configuration of Irish society, the pyramid with massive numbers on the margin, massive numbers at risk, and those massive numbers were ultimately to fall victim to the 1840s famine, the Great Famine of Ireland. So those are the three sort of areas I want to sort of talk about. There are three conclusions I want to try and bring forward. And I've chosen to put these three conclusions around the concept of total war. Now, as most of you will know, the concept of total war is one that has been reserved entirely for the conflicts of the 20th century. But more recently, however, historians impressed with what one describes as the astonishing transformation in the scope and intensity of warfare during the Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars have begun to view these struggles through the lens of a total war. Now, it's not difficult to understand why this should be so, why this concept of total war has been pressed into service for the Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars. Look, first of all, at the scale of mobilisation among the combatants. The British Regular Army saw a six-fold increase to 250,000 between 1790 and 1815. And this has to be set alongside a further 500,000 volunteers who were ready to act should there be an invasion. And in addition to this, there was a further 500,000 paid for by Britain among her allies on the continent. The Royal Navy peaked at 150,000 sailors in 1814. Tiny Prussia imposed conscription and raised an army of 250,000. The Tsar of Russia had 1 million men under arms by 1813. and the French fielded nearly as many during the wars. Casualties were staggering. Perhaps 5 million dead in Europe, while France alone lost 1 million, not counting the 200,000 slain in the Vendean Civil War of the 1790s. So to put this another way, some 20% of the adult male cohort born in France in the 1780s and early 1790s perished in these wars, some 20%. In fact, the French losses for the First World War were around 25%. So there is sort of an equivalence between the scale of the losses. In fact, the military participation ratio, the formula used generally to measure a given state's mobilisation for war, suggests a level of engagement that compares favourably with that of the countries that fought in the Great War, a conflict which is sometimes seen as the first total war. For example, Ireland, with a population of between 4 and 5 million in the 1790s, which was a population figure similar to that of 1914, sent at least 150,000 recruits to the British Armed Forces during the Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars, a number not too far distant from her contribution in the Great War. We have these figures, incidentally, and apropos where I am tonight, as a result of the researches of D.A. Chart, the first director of the Public Record Office, who published an article in 1917 on the Irish levies for the Napoleonic Wars in the English Historical Reviews. So that's the first point, the scale of mobilisation. The second is the numbers deployed on the battlefields. Prior to 1790, few battles had more than 100,000 combatants. But in 1809, the Battle of Wagram saw some 300,000 engaged on both sides, while no fewer than 500,000 fought the Battle of Leipzig in 1813. Only, curiously, 150,000 soldiers were engaged in the ultimately decisive Battle of Waterloo, with around 50,000 casualties on both sides. Third is, and central to the concept of total war, is the fact of what has been called significant alterations in the territory or the political system of every single European state, brought about by the complete mobilisation of a society's resources to achieve the absolute destruction of an enemy. And here too the picture is clear. The map of Europe was substantially redrawn as a result of the wars of 1793 to 1815. Poland in effect disappeared for 100 years. Ireland suffered the loss of her quasi-independent legislature through union with Great Britain in 1801. While further afield, the British Empire expanded significantly in Africa, the Caribbean and the Far East. Britain had 26 colonies in 1793. It had 43 in 1816. So it's arguable that the 7 Years' War of 56 to 70 to 63, normally seen as the Great War for Empire, in fact is eclipsed by the Revolutionary and Napoleonic War. The acquisition of empire during these decades has sort of been lost to history. It's worth just bearing it in mind. So far as resources are concerned, it could be argued that Britain's defeat of Napoleon's empire was due primarily to her superior economic and financial weapons and their effective deployment. Britain may or may not have outfought Bonaparte's France, but she certainly outspent her. Between 1790 and 1813, Britain spent some 830 million on the army, the navy, and on ordnance, with some 600 million added to the national debt. France had simply no answer to this. Lastly, the distinguished military historian David A. Bell, in arguing that the Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars constituted a total war, notes that a key feature of total war, one that distinguished it from earlier conflicts, was, as he puts it, the elimination of all distinction between combatant and non-combatant. And here he identifies the merciless guerrilla warfare carried on in Spain, northern Italy, Poland, and especially in the Vendée region of West France. They all, he argues, support his contention. Absolute enmity. We might note as well that parts of Ireland, however, notably South Ulster, North Leinster, were dubbed a Vendée by some British officers in the 1790s, and they urged the deployment of the same terror tactics as the French Revolutionary armies in that area. The contention of this paper is that the major political, social and economic changes of the period 1790 to 1815 cannot be properly assessed without due recognition of the titanic struggle underway between Britain and France. It is with an armed doctrine that we are at war, claimed the Irish-born English politician Edmund Burke in 1796, and it was this fusion of ideology and war that made conflict so intractable, so prolonged, and ultimately so momentous for Ireland and Europe. Now, it was evident from the outbreak of hostilities in February 1793 that the coming conflict was no ordinary Ancien Régime-style limited war. Within a matter of months, some 56 regiments had been added to the British Army, with no fewer than 22 raised in Ireland. By 1801, nearly 500,000 men had been mobilised. In 1794, one-third of the British Army became Irish, and by and large Irish Catholic, a proportion that continued and was sometimes exceeded down through the 19th century. The figures for the Royal Navy are no less striking. From 17,000 men in 1792, the Navy rose to 85,000 in 1801, with some 40% of landsmen, the lowest grade in the Navy, being Irish, and with an overall percentage for all grades of between 20 and 25%. This is a result of new research carried out on the composition of the Royal Navy in the 1790s. So about 20 to 25% overall were Irish. Now, this extraordinary turnaround in the composition of the armed forces has rarely been studied, but its implications are potentially far-reaching. Irish Catholics had been barred from all branches of the armed forces since the late 17th century, and while there have been frequent cases of improper enlistment of Irish recruits, by and large this prohibition had been defended and maintained, at least in public. Admittedly, with the growing manpower needs of the far-flung British Empire since 1756, a blind eye had increasingly been turned to the recruitment of Irish Catholics, and they had become prominent in forces serving abroad, in the regiments in the British colonies of North America, in Gibraltar and in India, where the East India Company had its own armament. Still, until 1793, officially, a blanket prohibition on Irish Catholic recruitment remained. In that year, the passing of a Catholic Relief Act in Ireland, revealingly a few weeks after France's declaration of war, made Irish Catholics eligible to hold most commissions in the armed forces, though only in Ireland. And this relaxation was taken as a green light for the open enlistment of Irish recruits. A massive recruitment campaign of Irish Catholics into the British Army and the Royal Navy was quickly underway and continued more or less until 1815. The formation of an Irish militia, again in 1793, was intended to assist in this process of mass recruitment. This essentially new formation was county-based, was some 20,000 strong, and would have an overwhelmingly Catholic rank and file with a Protestant, whether Church of Ireland or Presbyterian officer corps. The Irish militia was initially designed for home defence in the coming struggle. The theory was it would free up regular soldiers to serve abroad. But from an early date, it was regarded as a possible and then a vital source of recruits for the regular regiments. There had been serious disturbances when the Irish militia was first mobilised, and Dublin Castle remained suspicious of its loyalty, especially after some evidence was uncovered of infiltration by subversives in 1797, and also, I think, in view of its allegedly poor performance against a modest French incursion in 1798 at Killala, County Mayo. So far as the castle was concerned, the obvious solution was to use the Irish militia as a nursery for the regular army, and large numbers and sometimes entire companies were enlisted or, quote-unquote, volunteered to serve abroad. This view that the Irish militia made far better soldiers abroad was facilitated by the successful establishment of the Irish Yeomanry Force in 1796, a force that was strongly Protestant, even Orange in composition, and hence indubitably loyal. As Sir Robert Peel, Chief Secretary, noted in 1815, they were the most vehement loyalty in Ireland. With the Protestant yeomen patrolling their areas, the way was cleared for the Catholic militia to be shipped out, or as another Chief Secretary, W.W. Poole, put it, to be got rid of from Ireland. By 1805, some 5,000 militiamen a year were entering the regulars. In 1811, in the teeth of Catholic opposition, a Militia Interchange Act was passed in order to facilitate the exchange of Irish militia regiments for English militia regiments and to promote the enlistment of the members of the Irish militia into the regular British Army. Through 1810, 11, 12, within these years, some 10,000 Irish militia on an annual basis were dispatched to England or further afield and were being replaced by English militia. Now, it's no exaggeration to say that without Irish recruits during the Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars, the British Army's onslaught on the French, Spanish and Dutch West Indian Islands from 1793 to 1801 would not have been possible, if only because it was Irish recruits that replenished the ranks of the fallen, of which there were many. Some 90,000 private soldiers served in the Caribbean theatre during these years, the 1790s. Most of them shipped out of Cork, and some 43,000 died, almost all from tropical diseases. Indeed, it has even been claimed that it was the huge number of Irish recruits during these wars that later permitted the British Army to fight Napoleon without resort to conscription. And as is well known, Wellington's successful peninsular campaigns from 1808 on could not have taken place without Irish recruits. By 1813, he was in command of an army in Spain of some 73,000 men, of whom a large proportion were Irish. In that theatre, the 88th Foot, or Connacht Rangers, achieved renown at Bosaco, Fuentes de Onoro, Ciudad Rodrigo, Badajoz and Salamanca. It was an Irish soldier who captured a French regimental eagle at Barossa, one of only five seized during the entire Napoleonic Wars. And lastly, it was Wellington's Irish troops who were credited with victory in the climactic battle of the Napoleonic Wars at Waterloo. Home Office Minister Lord Sidmouth conceded, as he put it, it was the supply of troops derived from Ireland that turned the scale on the 18th of June at Waterloo. Nor was Ireland's contribution to the defeat of revolutionary France and the downfall of Napoleon confined to recruits. In matters of finance, Ireland was important to the British war effort, and in the supply of provisions for the armed forces, she was to prove vital. Funding for soldiers, whether regulars, militiamen or yeomanry on the Irish establishment, soared as the numbers recruited and paid for by Ireland surged upwards. The cost of the armed forces in Ireland was around £500,000 in 1792, £500,000. This rose steeply to £5.5 million in 1800 and peaked at £6,200,000 in 1804 before falling back to around £4 million in 1815 as the war was drawing to an end. Now, these outlays were simply unsustainable, and Ireland came near to bankruptcy through the scale of her outpourings to pay for troops and for other war-related expenses. British government nervousness at the powerless state of Irish finances was a factor in the quest for a legislative union. For the bags of cash being conveyed to the Irish government in the late 1790s, both to bail it out and enable it to make necessary payments, were an added argument in favour of a legislative takeover, duly accomplished with the Act of Union. Finance recruits were important, but provisions for the armed forces, I think, were literally vital. The Cork region dominated the supply of provisions to both the army and the navy, and the area met the enormous demand for beef, pork, butter, oats and beer. Cork merchants and Munster graziers, cattle dealers and farmers prospered, and so too did cattle dealers throughout Ireland. In 1811, some 45,000 cattle were shipped across the Irish Sea, a figure that was matched in other years, 45,000. It was a similar story with the export of horses. Most of the 2,000 or so horses shot on the evacuation of Sir John Moore's army from La Coruña in 1808 had originated at the famous horse fair at Ballinasloe. Even Bonaparte was rumoured to have bought his horse Marengo at Ballinasloe, but it's not... pretty much not true. Overall, it has been estimated that the grazier's income rose on average to 2% per annum during the wars. But if their incomes rose, such emphatically was not the case with subsistence farmers or cottiers, those who needed land for food and rent. Increasingly, they found themselves squeezed out of the land that they intended for cultivation. but which was now destined for cattle grazing. Moreover, a series of poor harvests due to unseasonable rain, cold weather, produced a poor return for the struggling tenant, and a growing population put added pressure on diminishing resources. Food prices rose steeply, caused by poor harvests, the demands of the military, and probably a certain amount of forestalling by the large producers. The result was a smothered and sometimes quite open species of class war in the Irish countryside from the mid-1790s on, in which cattle were hawked, that is, had their hamstrings sliced. Strangers, i.e. anyone from outside the neighbourhood, were flogged and warned off, and wagons or barges carrying grain were on occasion seized by hungry crowds. Again, wartime demand for dead stock, beef, livestock, cattle and horses, dry stock, biscuit, and even wet stock, pork, allied to robust population growth, led to growing subdivision of holdings at the lower end of the rural Irish social pyramid, and with this a necessary dependence on the prolific, if fickle, potato. Might I suggest that it is from the period of the French Wars, as the Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars had once been styled, from the French Wars that the malign configuration of the Irish population structure, one that was to collapse in catastrophe in the 1840s, can be dated. As early as 1807, one alarmed observer was observing how, in Tipperary, population growth, quote, was exceeding every estimate which has been made of it, and noting that the people, quote, live upon potatoes which require no great industry to cultivate and spend all their leisure time at wakes and funerals and drinking houses. By the war's end, in short, by 1815, a large and a growing proportion of the Irish rural population found itself increasingly at risk, and to no more cause more pertinent than the impact of the wars themselves. And if we are to add to the militarisation which I've been describing, the fact, put simply, that men in uniform were everywhere in Ireland through the 1790s and 1800s, the massive amount of recruitment, if we add to mobilisation, we have to add politicisation, because the two go hand in hand, I think we can see the impact of this in the post-1815 period and in the 1820s. Remember O'Connell's campaign and those descriptions of his followers who were well drilled and who marched in military formation, or at least appeared to march in what was something like military formation. I think this was all part of the anxiety of the authorities over the whole impact of the war on Irish people. It might have been expected that Ireland, and especially Catholic Ireland's signal contribution to final victory in the Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars, would have elicited warm encomia from British officials in Dublin Castle, or indeed would have drawn major rewards from the London government. But neither of these happened. Thus, while the Scottish Highland regiments were feted for their sterling services in the war, rewarded with a triumphant parade through Edinburgh, and immortalised by various artists on canvas, the Irish soldier was, by and large, ignored. Worse, there seemed to be no incongruity or embarrassment in celebrating the triumphs of Wellington and his men, while at the same time, as W.C. Plunkett, MP for Trinity College Dublin, put it, pronouncing an irrevocable doom on those Irish Catholic soldiers who had opened the sluices of their heart's blood in the service of the Empire. Some years after 1815, a less elevated witness, less elevated than W.C. Plunkett, a balladeer, summed up the case rather well. O Wellington, sure you know it is true, in blood we were drenched at famous Waterloo. We fought for our king to uphold his crown, our only reward was papists lie down. It was evident that by 1815 there had crystallised in official circles on both sides of the Irish Sea a deep suspicion of Ireland and the Irish, a contrast, I think, with the early 1790s, 1780s, with a widespread view of the island as an enemy's country, to be held under, quote, the garrison principle. This revealed itself, as I've mentioned, to the policy of keeping Irish soldiers abroad while introducing English or Scottish soldiers to Ireland. The plan was, quote, that the troops quartered in Great Britain shall be Irish Roman Catholics recruited here, and those quartered in Ireland shall be stout English Protestants recruited in England, unquote. Along with this security policy, as already noted, there was renewed determination not to yield on the Catholic question, and this was new. In the 1790s, it looked as if Catholic emancipation would be a formality, a matter of a few months or a few years, but not after 1815. Now, admittedly, there was widespread fear post-1815 among the governing elite in both Ireland and Britain that to concede on the Catholic question might lead to further demands from other excluded groups, notably dissenters or Jews. A concession might even re-energise the campaign for parliamentary reform in Britain, currently in the doldrums. And of course, Britain was not alone in this resistance to liberal reforms. After 1815, from Prussia to Russia, from Spain, Austria and on to France, every effort was made by the ruling classes to deny any political benefits from the outcome of the interminable wars to the general populace. And yet the vehemence with which the line was defended on the Catholic question was exceptional. I think the case of Edward Wright, Royal Navy, is perhaps instructive. He had joined the Royal Navy in 1796, along with his four brothers, who were subsequently killed in action. He had taken part in many naval engagements and eventually was rewarded with a commission as commander in 1815. But he could not, as a Catholic in conscience, take the required oaths. To his dismay, he was drummed out of the Navy and his half pay was denied after 20 years' service. In a sense, total war against the French had been replaced by total resistance to Catholic demands, and I think the two are very much related. Thank you very much.